You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, September 15th. I'm Teresa from Drake University. Here's our first story. Bluffs schools to remask. Other CB schools wait for final verdict by Tim Johnson. And there's a picture with children, they look pretty young, walking out of the school. They all have their masks on, and it looks like they're right in front of the front doors. Council Bluffs Community School District wasted no time returning to its previous face mask policy after a federal judge blocked enforcement of Iowa's ban on school mask mandates Monday. Other local schools remained cautious about making changes in their protocols. Beginning Wednesday, September 15th, all Council Bluffs Community School Districts, students, staff, and visitors will be expected to wear masks at school during school hours when physical distancing is not possible to help control the spread of the coronavirus, according to a message from Superintendent Vicki Murillo sent to staff and parents Tuesday morning. Students will not have to wear a mask when seated to eat breakfast or lunch or while participating in recess or outdoor classroom activities, the message stated. Our extracurricular and co-curricular activities will remain unchanged until we receive guidance from our state athletic and music associations. The district's mask expectations may be revised, depending on the outcome of ongoing legal action, the message added. We do recognize that members of our school community have varying opinions on the wearing of masks, the message stated. As a school district, we have the responsibility to make decisions based on state and federal law and are doing so with the implementation of this change in expectations based on yesterday's order. The school district will continue to do the following. Make masks available at school. Encourage regular hand washing and sanitizing opportunities throughout the day, especially before and after eating. Regularly clean high touch points and practice enhanced daily sanitation of all classrooms. We will also continue to track and monitor the positive COVID-19 case totals and trends in each school and throughout the school district, notify parents and staff of positive cases, and collaborate with the Pottawatomie County Health Department as appropriate to determine if we need to adjust our practices and mitigation measures, Murillo said in the message. Lewis Central Community School District will continue to encourage the use of masks, but will make no immediate changes in its policies, Superintendent Eric Noss said Tuesday. This decision just came yesterday afternoon, and it is not clear as to how the courts will ultimately rule on this matter, Noss said in a message to families and staff. If such mandates are to remain an option for local school boards to consider beyond this temporary order, there will be many, many factors that will guide our board's decision-making. In the meantime, until we better understand the final outcome, Lewis Central will not be altering our current protocol. St. Albert Catholic School planned to stick to the status quo, according to Kevin White, communications coordinator. As always, we respect the parents' choice in this matter, he said. Heartland Christian School does not plan to make any changes, Executive Director Larry Gray said. We will continue with our mask optional protocol, he said. Because of the Delta variant of COVID-19, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends universal mask usage by all students and staff regardless of vaccination status. The CDC points to multiple studies in multiple countries that show masks help reduce the spread of COVID-19. Experimental and epidemiological data support community masking to reduce the spread of SARS-CoV-2, aka COVID-19, the CDC said, noting the prevention benefit is twofold. Wearing a mask helps protect both the wearer and those around them. Public health officials, doctors, and others in the healthcare field recommend a COVID-19 vaccine, eating healthy, and practicing good hygiene among measures against the disease. As reported by the Associated Press, a federal judge on Monday ordered the state of Iowa to immediately halt enforcement of a law that prevents school boards from ordering masks to be worn to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. According to the AP, Judge Robert Pratt said in an order signed Monday that the law passed in May substantially increases the risk of several children with health conditions of contracting COVID-19. Pratt said he has looked at data on the effectiveness of masks to reduce spread of the virus and agrees with recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American Academy of Pediatrics on mask wearing in schools. because plaintiffs have shown that Iowa Code Section 280.31's ban on mask mandates in schools substantially increases their risk of contracting the virus that causes COVID-19 and that, due to their various medical conditions, they are at an increased risk of severe illness or death. Plaintiffs have demonstrated that an irreparable harm exists, he wrote. His order said Governor Kim Reynolds and Iowa Department of Education Director Ann Lebo cannot enforce the new law banning local school districts from using their discretion to mandate masks for students, staff, teachers, and visitors. Reynolds said in a statement that the judge unilaterally overturned a state law, ignored the decision by our elected legislator, and took away parents' ability to decide what is best for their child. She said the state will appeal and exercise every legal option we have to uphold state law and defend the rights and liberties afforded to any American citizen protected by our Constitution. Hours after the decision was announced, Des Moines Public Schools Superintendent Thomas Ahart said he would reinstate a mask mandate for all students, staff, and visitors to the district schools beginning Wednesday. Des Moines Schools is the state's largest district with about 33,000 students. Masks will be required for all students, staff, and visitors in Cedar Rapids schools, the district superintendent said Tuesday. The Iowa City School Board was expected to discuss options on Tuesday night. Pratt pointed out that it's been almost 40 years since the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that, regardless of citizenship status, denying school-aged children a free public education violates the U.S. Constitution. He said the parents want Iowa school districts to have the opportunity to comply with federal law and ensure that each child receives an education in the least restrictive and the most integrated environment, without jeopardizing their lives or safety. Iowa's mask mandate ban makes it not only dangerous for disabled or immunocompromised children to attend school, but several pediatricians opine it is also dangerous for healthy siblings to attend school in person because they risk carrying the virus back to their disabled or immunocompromised siblings, Pratt said. He said that the AAP has recorded about 3,500 new COVID-19 cases among Iowa school-aged children since July, and some public schools in Iowa are experiencing COVID-19 infection rates at upwards of 60% of last year's total for the entire school year. In the most recent state public health update, children aged 17 and younger made up 29% of the new coronavirus cases in Iowa. 15 children under age 17 were hospitalized with COVID-19, including 12 under the age of 11. Lebo has said any districts that violate the law will be referred to the State Board of Education and risk loss of funding. Pratt also points out that the motion by the parents to halt enforcement of the law comes on the heels of the U.S. Department of Education's investigation into whether Iowa's mask mandate ban violates the Americans with Disabilities Act and Rehabilitation Act by discriminating against school-aged children with disabilities. The parents in the lawsuit claim similar violations of federal law. They claim that in-person learning is essential and point out that Lebo remarked in January 2021 that a return to in-person learning is necessary as students engaged in remote learning are falling behind academically. The parents of these children thus lament the choice of having to either send their children to school in person with the rest of their kids their age without a mask mandate or swallow the lesser option that it is not always available to them, remote learning, Pratt said. He concluded that the law seems to conflict with the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act because it excludes disabled children from participating in and denies them the benefits of public schools programs, services, and activities to which they are entitled. Across the Missouri River in Nebraska, and the Bellevue Public School System policy requires that if a single person tests positive for COVID-19 in a classroom, everyone in the class will have to wear a mask for 14 days. On Monday, the Papillion La Vista Community School Board of Education ratified and affirmed updates to the district's mask guidelines as enacted by Superintendent Andy Rickles under emergency powers. Omaha Public Schools require masks as well. And this story was from Nonpareil Interim Managing Editor Mike Brownlee, Bellevue Leader Reporter Austin Plord, Papillion Times Reporter Adam Branting, and Associated Press Reporter David Pitt. Our next story is titled, Riverside to Induct 6 Alumni and 1 Athletic Team into Hall of Fame, by Tim Johnson. Riverside Community School District will add 6 alumni and a softball team to the Riverside Hall of Fame this week. The induction ceremony for the Hall of Fame class of 2021 will be held at 2:30 p.m. Thursday in the gymnasium at Riverside Middle High School. 18997 Highway 59 in Oakland. Honorees will include Wiley Duan Bussey, Distinguished Graduate, Oakland Class of 1957, Delbert Burt Bailey, Distinguished Graduate, Oakland Class of 1979, David Weaver, Distinguished Graduate, Oakland Class of 1984, Mike Osborne, Distinguished Graduate, Carson Macedonia Class of 1989, Marianne D'Angelo, Distinguished Graduate, Oakland Class of 1992, Stacy Cole, Distinguished Graduate, Oakland Class of 1992, and the 1958 Carson Macedonia softball team with Coach Ken Roberts. And there's a picture, it looks like a women's softball team, and it looks like they're holding a trophy. The year the year is 1958, and it is the Karen Macedonia softball team, and their coach is named Ken Roberts. Wiley Duan Bussey. Bussey was born September 23, 1939, in Council Bluffs to Werner Bud and Martha Edith Bussey. He died January 12, 2021, at age 81, at his home east of Oakland. Throughout his high school career, he was a multi-sport athlete playing football, baseball, track, and basketball. He participated in Glee Club, Mixed Chorus, was class vice president and president of FFA. During his football career in Oakland, he was honored by selection as an all-state football player, one class, in 1956, playing at the center position. He also received first-team honors through the Daily Nonpareil, first-team honors through the Omaha World Herald, first-team honors a Southwest Iowa Conference, and academic honor roll. Bussey was offered a full-ride scholarship to the University of Nebraska, which he declined to enlist in the service. He was enlisted in the Army and served in Washington, D.C. at the Pentagon. After being honorably discharged, he returned to Oakland and worked with his father raising hogs, showing horses, and farming. On March 9, 1973, he married Connie Beckendorf. They had two children, Rachel and Rebecca. The family lived near Hancock until 1979 and then built a house and moved east of Oakland. He retired from farming in 2018. He was a member of the Oakland United Methodist Church. He served multiple years on the Oakland Community School Board, served as a member of the Pottawatomie County Pork Producers, and sold Hodgemeyer seed corn. He was a proud follower of Riverside Sports. Delbert Burt Bailey. After graduating from Oakland High School, Bailey went on to earn a Bachelor of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering from Iowa State University, graduating in 1983. He then had a long career with the Boeing Company from 1983 to 2015, where he worked on multiple airplane projects supporting both commercial and military programs. He held positions as design engineer, senior engineer, lead engineer, first line manager, senior manager, associate technical fellow, and technical fellow. As associate technical fellow and technical fellow, he was responsible for establishing performance expectations and standards for technical personnel and for guiding and mentoring upcoming engineers. During his career, he was awarded 5 U.S. patents and 3 international patents. He was recognized as Boeing Commercial Airplane Systems Engineer of the Year, was a member and chairman for the International Aerospace Association A10 Oxygen System Standards and Rulemaking Body. He has been involved in his community by serving as a science docent, Little League umpire, and church confirmation class guide. He has served as a technical advisor to 3 different homeowners associations for building structural remediations, president and water chairman for a private water system. He has also supported the Guide Dogs of America organization. David Weaver. Weaver is an advertising agency veteran, strategic planner, relentless self-experimenter, provocateur, longtime Tedster, and according to many, a darn nice guy. He has over 30 years of experience directing marketing strategy for some of the most respected and innovative companies in the world. He has led and created award-winning advertising campaigns for Nissan, Hershey, T-Mobile, Clif Bar, American Airlines, Nestle, Adidas, Nationwide Insurance, and many others. He spoke on the TED, originally Technology, Entertainment, and Design, main stage in 2021, TED Active in 2011, and TED in Phoenix and TED in Omaha in 2020, and TED in SMU in 2021. He is the founder of Outsiderism, a coaching and training service designed to help leaders increase their creativity and creative thinking to be more innovative and more successful. After living in major metropolitan markets like Seattle, Kansas City, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Brooklyn, he now lives in Underhill, Vermont with his wife, Misuk, and their wire Fox. His sister, Stacy Cole, is also being inducted into the Riverside School Community District Hall of Fame Class of 2021. Mike Osborne. After graduating from Carson, Macedonia, Osborne attended Creighton University with the intention of going to medical school. After 2.5 years of undergraduate work, he decided to change course and pursue business. He left college and, over the course of the next 15 years, bought and sold 2 technology-related businesses, Website Results co-founder and COO 1995 to 2001, and Awareness Technology co-founder, and Awareness Technology co-founder and CFO 2002 to 2009. He then saw an opportunity to revolutionize healthy eating and co-founded Quest Nutrition in January 2010. He served as CFO January 2010 to January 2016 and COO January 2016 to April 2017, when it was acquired by Simple Good Foods. He and his partners built the company into a globally recognized nutrition company that sold products in nearly 70 countries worldwide. He has spearheaded the donation of hundreds of thousands of dollars of product to various food banks and homeless shelters. He is an active coach and sponsor of local youth sports and has mentored numerous young adults. His philanthropy includes the Epigenics Foundation, Red Cross, National Wildlife Federation, Feeding America, Los Angeles Mission, ASPCA, and various other organizations. Marianne D'Angelo. D'Angelo graduated from Oakland High School in 1992 and received a bachelor's degree in accounting from Creighton University, JD, from Creighton University School of Law, and LLM in taxation from Georgetown University Law Center. She is a certified public accountant and is a member of the Iowa Bar Association, the American Bar Association, and the AICPA. She currently lives in Minneapolis. She is a Transaction Tax Advisory Executive Director in Ernst & Young's LLP, International Tax and Transaction Services Practice, ITTS. She has served 20 years of experience serving a variety of corporate and private equity clients, advising them on various tax matters. After law school, Marianne spent 8 years in the merger and acquisition group at PricewaterhouseCooper, LLP, and the Washington National Tax Service Office. She subsequently spent 2 years as senior tax counsel at Cargill Incorporated, a multinational privately held corporation located in Minneapolis. She has presented on M&A tax topics as part of the Texas Executive Institute and the Minnesota Bar Association Tax Institute, as well as published articles in the Journal of Corporate Taxation and Tax Advisor. She is also a member of EY's ITTS Diversity Council and the Minneapolis Racial Equality Steering Committee and serves as a relationship advisor to the firm's Entrepreneur Access Network, supporting Black and Latino businesses. She has been awarded with an Inclusiveness Award within the firm. She also serves on an advisory board for PACER Center, an organization that is a champion for children, youth, and young adults with disabilities. Stacy Cole, another 1992 graduate of Oakland High School, Cole worked at Dairy Queen and the local golf course and was involved in numerous activities throughout her high school career. She is the youngest daughter of Mike and Cheryl Weaver and has an older brother, David, who is also being inducted into the Riverside Hall of Fame class of 2021. She went to Buena Vista University, where she earned the ZZ White Leadership Scholarship, which challenged her to find leadership opportunities in every aspect of her life. She has taken those leadership lessons with her, earning additional degrees from Southwest Minnesota State University, Morningside College, Iowa State University, and the University of Florida. In 2018, she earned the Central Office Administrator of the Year Award, given by the School Administrators of Iowa, for her work in establishing a strong teacher leadership program in Storm Lake Community Schools. She is currently the superintendent of the Storm Lake Community School District, a diverse community in Northwest Iowa. She serves more than 2,500 students and their families, focusing on overcoming barriers that affect marginalized populations. She serves in the community on the Salud Community Group as a Habitat for Humanity volunteer, Storm Lake Library Board member, and Storm Lake United Board member. Her various volunteer activities include working food pantry events, writing grants for community organizations, coaching numerous youth activities, Storm Lake Booster Club, Storm Lake Music Booster Club volunteer, volunteering with a local Thanksgiving meal, and at numerous benefits for community members in need. And finally, the 1958 Carson Macedonia softball team. The 1958 Carson Macedonia softball team placed second at the 1958 Iowa State softball tourney. This was the first merged sports venture of the two schools, and it was a successful one. The tourney was held at the Greenwood Electric Field in Des Moines. Argyle scored 7 runs in the first 3 innings and went on to defeat Carson Macedonia 13-5 for the championship. Sandra Smith hit a home run in the 3rd inning for the second-place finishers. They beat Arisp in the semifinal by getting 9 hits and scoring an 11-1 victory. Virginia Brunning pitched a 3-hitter. Coach Roberts stated, "The entire lineup can hit, and usually does, but Virginia Brunning and Linda Boroff are the aces at the plate." I really enjoyed that story. That was really nice to hear about some important people. The next story is called Redistricting Session Set for October 5th, Court Okays More Time, by David Pitt. In Des Moines, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on Tuesday set a special legislative session for October 5th to approve redrawn legislative and congressional district maps, and the Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court signed an order giving lawmakers extra time to complete their task. Reynolds signed a proclamation convening the special session to take up redistricting, a once-a-decade process that was complicated this year by a delay in releasing U.S. Census Bureau data blamed on the coronavirus pandemic. Also Tuesday, Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Susan Christensen signed an order allowing the nonpartisan legislative services industry to submit maps to the legislator as outlined in Iowa law, even though they will be completed after the legally mandated deadline. She has given them up until December 1st to come up with new maps. The census data was made public August 16 following a 5-month delay from its original deadline. The delay sent states scrambling to revise redistricting deadlines. The Iowa Constitution requires the process to be completed before September 1st. If new maps are not approved by September 15th, the Iowa Supreme Court is given the power to cause the state to be apportioned by December 31st. Christensen's order said the court, using its constitutional authority, permits the LSA and the legislature to proceed with the process as outlined and have new maps by December 1st. Iowa law spells out in great detail how the LSA must draw the maps to minimize gerrymandering and political influence in initial drafting. The LSA says it will release the first maps on Thursday. State law gives the 5-member Iowa Temporary Redistricting Advisory Commission 14 days to hold public hearings to gather comment once the maps are released and prepare a report for the legislature. The commission has rescheduled the hearings for September 20th, 21st, and 22nd. Republicans hold a majority in the legislature, so they will have the power to approve or reject the first set of maps. They must be approved or rejected without modification. Democratic leaders have committed to voting in favor of the first maps the LSA draws, saying Iowa's process assures that the maps will be nonpartisan and fair. Republican leaders have declined to make such a pledge. Iowa House Republicans are eager to get to work on redistricting after months of delays. Iowa's nonpartisan redistricting process is considered one of the fairest in all 50 states. We've worked with the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency and the Supreme Court to ensure that the integrity of our highly praised redistricting process is maintained, House Speaker Pat Grassley said in a statement. If the first maps are rejected, the LSA has 35 days to draw up a second set of maps. Lawmakers again must vote them up or down. If that plan is rejected, the LSA again has 35 days to draw a third set. Lawmakers may amend the maps like any other legislation before approving them. Face of the day, and this is Emerson Freeman. She is a younger woman with blonde hair, and she has a camera set on the table in front of her. Emerson Freeman loves documenting and capturing families' big moments as they grow together. Freeman, 18, is a Council Bluffs native who attended Hoover Elementary School, Kern Middle School, and Abraham Lincoln High School, where she graduated from last summer. Freeman is quite the shutterbug, and she's been snapping photos for as long as she can remember. She says she grew up with using whatever means she had, usually an iPad, before finally getting a DSLR camera when she was 13. It was a Nikon D750, and it's been her baby ever since. Today, Freeman works out of Mac and V Photography Studio, where she serves as the family photographer and social media manager for the family photography side of the business. Freeman said it's been a great collaboration, noting how co-founders Michaela Clark and Vivian Kavam handle the business side of things to give her more time to put creative labor into her work. Freeman says it brings her much joy to capture the big life moments for all of the families she works with. Being the oldest of seven siblings, she said she's been getting plenty of practice in capturing candid moments of her brothers and sisters growing up. They're really good practice subjects, she said with a laugh. Freeman says she enjoys photography and design because there is always something new to learn. Just out of high school, she said she plans on enrolling at the photography program at Metropolitan Community College across the river to hone her skills. When she isn't behind the lens, Freeman said she loves spending time with family and going shopping with friends. More about Freeman, her work, and the studio can be found at macandv.com. macandv.com. Buffalo carved out of butter featured at Kansas State Fair. Hutchinson, Kansas. Kansas's state animal, the buffalo, is being celebrated at the state fair this year with a 700-pound butter sculpture. The Hutchinson News reports that a sculptor from Iowa, Sarah Pratt, had to do some research on buffaloes before she designed this year's butter statue. Pratt says if she winds up with any extra butter out of the 700 pounds she has to work with, she may add a buffalo calf or some sunflowers. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, September 15th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Teresa from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. On the opinion page today, there is a political comment, political comic that depicts a man in a trench coat opening one side of the coat, and he is asking a woman walking by vaccination cards. So it looks almost like he's trying to give out vaccination cards to people passing. It looks like he's in some sort of alley. Drone killing should mark end of 9/11 era, by Will Bunch. President Joe Biden signaled to America and the world that he'd be a different kind of commander-in-chief when he moved this summer to finally end the nearly 20-year forever war in Afghanistan, a bold step that his predecessors Barack Obama and Donald Trump had not taken, despite their own qualms about the mission. But when a suicide bomber tied to the terror group ISIS-K attacked the throng at the gates to Kabul's airport seeking to flee the country after its rapid fall to the Taliban and killed 13 U.S. service members and dozens of Afghans, Biden's rhetoric fell back on the tried and true. America has the superior know-how and military might to exact deadly revenge. To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive, Biden said from the White House that night, August 26th. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay. His words felt very much like a clapback to George W. Bush's 2001 bullhorn moment with workers at the rubble of the World Trade Center when he vowed to get the masterminds of the 9/11 attack. A short time later, America indeed struck back. The next night, Pentagon officials said that a U.S. drone strike in a remote corner of Afghanistan killed a planner of the attack from the terror group ISIS-K, although it was hard to check that, and locals said a woman and child were killed along with a man. Next, a second attack seemed to show that the Biden administration was indeed in control of the situation on the ground in Kabul. At that drone strike, U.S. military officials claimed intelligence had been tracking a would-be second bomber and blew up his vehicle before it reached the crowded airport. But things looked very different on the ground, as they so often had in the 20-year crusade that our nation's leaders dubbed the War on Terror. Neighborhood residents said 10 people had been killed in the U.S. attack, most of them children. And then, in a tragically ironic twist, The New York Times and the Washington Post reported on the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks that triggered the terror wars that there is substantial evidence that the man America targeted in the drone strike wasn't a terrorist at all, but an ally, one of the good guys. Times reported that the very last U.S. missile fired in its two-decade-long war in Afghanistan, a righteous strike, according to the Pentagon, launched from a flying death robot that is called a Reaper drone, killed Zamari Ahmadi, a 43-year-old veteran aid worker for a U.S.-based company, in addition to the 9 other civilians, including 7 children. Reporting by the 2 papers uncovered no evidence that Ahmadi had any connection to terrorism and suggested his murder was the result of tragically flawed assumptions by U.S. intelligence, who came to believe the man had been in contact with an ISIS-K safe house in Kabul. But witnesses told the Times that what Ahmadi loaded into his Corolla was not explosives, but water bottles for his family. Indeed, the Post reported that forensic evidence found the explosion at the killing site was equal to that caused by a U.S. missile, suggesting there was no bombs in the van. Any secondary explosion was probably just the Toyota's fuel tank. "We have nothing to do with terrorism or ISIS," the Kabul-based director of the program Ahmadi worked for told the Times. The director said he was on the list for U.S. resettlement. "We love America. We want to go there." Beyond its timing, the paradox of this immorally flawed American killing of innocents is almost too much to bear. On one hand, it is arguably the worst action of Biden's 8 months in the White House, a blundered rush to show presidential resolve and U.S. military might at a time when critics were charging the White House with losing control of the situation in Kabul. The deep irony is that Team Biden's lethal mistake also shows the 46th president was absolutely right to end U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and wind down America's broader forever war when he did. Coming right before the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, Ahmadi's senseless death became the exclamation point on a righteous U.S. response that went horribly wrong. To be clear, Biden's "we will hunt you down" bluster and the wrong-headed, deadly responses that seem to flow from that is nothing new, and in fact predates 9/11. Richard Nixon knew the Vietnam War was unwinnable, yet feared an abrupt ending would make America look weak. So 20,000 more U.S. troops and countless innocent Vietnamese died on his watch. Both Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan responded to humiliation and loss. The 1975 fall of Saigon and the 1983 Beirut-Barak bombing, with military strikes that were poorly planned. Ford's SS Mayaguez assault, in which 40 Americans died, or strategically baffling, Reagan's Grenada invasion. After al-Qaeda bombed U.S. embassies in 1998, Bill Clinton ordered the bizarre bombing of a Sudanese medical factory. After the 9/11 attacks, the overriding goal of the George W. Bush administration was to project U.S. strength on a broad global canvas, to prove that America, which indeed spends more on its military than the next 10 nations combined, was still the world's lone superpower to be feared. Bush believed that the threat of U.S. power had lost credibility because of terror attacks culminating in 9/11, according to the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Thus, the response went well beyond the reasonable. Eliminating the safe haven for Osama bin Laden and other terrorists in Afghanistan and tightening security at home. Into projects like the 2003 invasion of Iraq, which had nothing to do with the assault on the World Trade Center. That the U.S. plan for massively bombing Baghdad was called shock and awe sums up the post-9/11 mindset. The last 20 years have provided plenty of shocks, but from a moral standpoint, the U.S. forever war has been less than awesome. Leaders failed to absorb the painful lessons of Vietnam, that American claims on democracy can't be easily imposed at the barrel of a gun, in lands that our generals and soldiers poorly understand. Last month's drone killing of Zamari Ahmadi was far from the only case of horrific collateral damage, nor was the mistaken U.S. 2008 airstrike on an Afghan wedding party that killed 47 innocent civilians, including the bride, just one of several such tragedies. It's been estimated that U.S. air attacks in the last 2 decades after 9/11 have killed at least 22,000 civilians, creating a new generation of anti-Americanism. Although the fall of Kabul was not the mainstream media's finest hour, there have also been some remarkable truth-telling, including the Times and the Post investigations of the August 29th drone strike, but also a recent piece in The New Yorker by Anand Gopal, the other Afghan women. It argued that the clear-cut gains for female empowerment in the relatively cosmopolitan capital of Kabul were offset by women in the countryside furious because they'd lost family members to U.S. military actions or the corrupt warlords we allied with. On average, Gopal writes of his thorough investigation of rural Afghan towns, I found each family lost 10 to 12 civilians in what locals call the American War. This is the wider truth, that the forever war sparked by 9/11 was making America look weak, both morally and as a driver of world events, and in creating new enmity in the multiple nations where we conducted drone strikes or other military actions, undermined our position in global affairs instead of strengthening it. This was Biden's crucible as he assumed leadership of that war. He would face continued pressure to project strength, often with hasty, misguided actions like the first Kabul drone strike, or he could start pulling the plug on a terribly misguided operation that had already killed thousands and wasted trillions of dollars. Leaving Afghanistan was literally the only way to stop America before we killed again. For now, we can only pray that Zamari Ahmadi was the last man to die for a mistake. And now for the obituaries. First, we have Linda Kennedy Wood, age 75, of Council Bluffs, has passed away September 14, 2021, at her daughter's home in Harlan, Iowa. Linda was born April 4, 1946, in Omaha, Nebraska, to the late Joseph and Blanche Kennedy. She graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1964. On July 21, 1967, Linda married Jerry Wood in Omaha. Linda worked at Frito-Lay for 15 years, retiring in 2001. In addition to her parents, Linda was preceded in death by her husband, Jake Wood, in 2017, sisters Elaine Kennedy and Karen Rocha, brother Gary Kennedy. Linda is survived by her daughter, Melanie Carpenter of Harlan, son, Brent Wood of Red Oak, Iowa, grandchildren, Jessica DeMonette, Trevor Wood, Matthew Wood, Allison Downing, and Colton Downing, great-grandchildren, Maggie Wood, Hudson Olson, Finley Wood, Baby DeMonnet, brother, Dennis Kennedy of Council Bluffs, many nieces, nephews, and in-laws. Visitation with the family, Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. A funeral service, Saturday, 1 p.m. at the funeral home, which is... The address for that is 545 Willow Avenue in Council Bluffs. The family will direct memorials. Virginia Turner Putnam. Virginia Elaine Turner Putnam, age 79, of Aurora, Colorado, passed away September 13, 2021, in Aurora. She was born October 21, 1941, to parents Theo Eugene and Roberta LaVon Turner of Oakland, Iowa. Ginny attended Center No. 1, a one-room schoolhouse east of her home through eighth grade. She attended Oakland, Iowa High School. She was united in marriage to Robert Putnam and was later divorced. Virginia was preceded in death by her parents and younger sister, Priscilla Turner Gearhart. Survivors include sons, David Putnam and Michael Putnam, granddaughters, Miranda and Michelle, all of Aurora, great-grandchildren, Evelyn, Zandra, Brooklyn, and twins, Kylie and Jack of Aurora, and sister Joan Turner Harrison of Council Bluffs. Jin was a member of the Order of Rainbow for Girls. Her interests included reading, walking with her furry friends, Xander and Minnie, trips to the Colorado Mountains with son Mike. She was not one to sit at home and worked many jobs. Only trucking in Oakland, Iowa, Hertz car rental, legs, and a lengthy employment with the Omaha Police Department, all in Omaha, Nebraska. Her sons, their families, and all of her grandchildren were her pride and joy. According to Virginia's wishes, no services will be held following cremation. Memorials may be made to Alzheimer's, Denver Dumb Friend League, which is a pet rescue, or multiple sclerosis. Jimmy Don Burgert. Jimmy Don Burgert, age 90, passed away Sunday, September 12, 2021, at Jenny Edmondson Hospital after an extended illness. He was born in Kansas on July 9, 1931, the son of G. Fred Burgert and G. Stella Burgert. He retired from Anderson Excavating to care for his wife, Donna Joanne Detman Burgert, who preceded him along with his sisters, Virginia of Texas, Validia of Kansas, brother Larry of Kansas, his daughter Julia Burgert Blau, and his great-granddaughter Candace Candace Blow. He is survived by his sisters, Pat Burgert Yeager of Kansas, Anna Lee Burgert Gilbert of New York, and Judy Burgert Gilliland, also of Kansas, daughters Deborah Yachulo of Las Vegas, Donna Jeffrey of Iowa, son James Frederick Burgert of Council Bluffs, 8 grandchildren, multiple great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren, along with nieces, nephews, great-nieces, nephews, and great-great-nieces and nephews. He was a longtime member of the Masonic Lodge in Kansas and served in the Army during the Korean campaign. Visitation Friday, 5 to 7 p.m., funeral service Sunday, 11 a.m., all at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Which again, the address for that is 545 Willow Avenue in Council Bluffs. Entombment in Ridgewood Mausoleum following the service. The family is asking that in lieu of flowers, donations be made to the American Cancer Society in his name. Billy L. Williams, age 83, of Council Bluffs, passed away September 12, 2021 at his home, surrounded by his loving family. Bill was born February 17, 1938, in Council Bluffs, to the late Vernon and Alice Viola Williams. He graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1957 and proudly served his country in the Iowa National Guard. Bill married Charlene Robinson on June 16, 1959, in Plattsmouth, Nebraska. They were blessed with 3 sons, Randy, Christopher, and Kirk. Bill was an automotive machinist owning B&J Machine from 1980 to 2019 and Williams Brothers Racing. He also worked at Genuine Auto Parts, NAPA, for 18 years. Bill is survived by his wife of 62 years, Charlene Williams of Council Bluffs, sons Randy J. Williams of Missouri Valley, Iowa, Christopher L. Williams of Council Bluffs, Kirk L. Williams of Glenwood, Iowa, 7 grandchildren, 5 great-grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. Visitation with the family, Wednesday, 5 to 7 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service Thursday, 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Again, 545 Willow Avenue in Council Bluffs. Entombment in the Ridgewood Mausoleum with full military rites. A lunch will follow at the Walnut Hill Reception Center, 1350 East Pierce Street. Memorials are suggested to St. Croix Hospice. LaVon Faye Pilling. LaVon Faye Pilling, known as Bonnie, age 98, of Council Bluffs, Iowa, formerly of Macedonia, passed away on Monday, September 13, 2021. She's survived by her children, Nancy Griffin of Centralia, Missouri, Hubert Pilling and friend, Barbie James of Council Bluffs, Iowa, and Don Pilling of Urbandale, Iowa, 7 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, and 7 great-great-grandchildren, sister-in-law Marilyn Pilling of Council Bluffs, Iowa, along with many nieces and nephews. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, September 16th, 2021, at the Macedonia United Methodist Church in Macedonia. Friends will be present to greet family will be present to greet friends at the church an hour before the service. Burial will be in the Macedonia Cemetery. Visitation, family will not be present, will be on Wednesday, September 15th, 2021, at the Lois Hills Funeral Home in Carson, Iowa, from 4 to 6 p.m. The location for that is 420 South Oak Street in Carson, Iowa. Memorials are to Macedonia United Methodist Church or Macedonia Historical Society. Arlene Hand. Arlene Hand, age 97, entered into rest on September 12th, 2021, with her family by her side. She was born July 27, 1924, to Clyde and Helen Obrecht. Arlene attended and graduated from Missouri Valley High School. On April 8, 1944, she was joined in union to Orrin Sparky Hand. She worked for many years as the office manager for Dr. Dewey, and after retiring, she then worked as a senior companion for Connections until the age of 91. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband, and son James Hand, 4 sisters, and 3 brothers. Arlene is survived by her son, John Hand, brothers Robert, Gaylord, Gig, and Keith, Doc, Obrecht, 3 grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, 3 great-great-grandchildren, and many nieces, nephews, cousins, and friends. A visitation will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. at Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home on Thursday, September 16, 2021. The location for that is 1221 North 16th Street in Council Bluffs. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. at the Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home on Friday, September 17th, 2021. Burial at Rose Hill Cemetery in Missouri Valley. The family will direct memorials. Norm MacDonald, former Saturday Night Live comic, dies, by David Bowder. And there's a photo of him at a comedy competition. It looks like he's holding a microphone. New York. Comedian Norm MacDonald, a former Saturday Night Live writer and performer who was Weekend Update host when Bill Clinton and O.J. Simpson provided comic fodder during the 1990s, has died. MacDonald, who is 61, died Tuesday after having cancer for 9 years but keeping it private, according to Brillstein Entertainment Partners, his management firm in Los Angeles. He never reached the same television heights after being fired from SNL in 1998, but was an indefatigable stand-up comic and popular talk show host whose death provoked an outpouring from fellow comedians. Norm was in a comedy genre of his own, tweeted Sarah Silverman. No one like him on this planet. Please do yourself a favor and watch his stuff. MacDonald, the son of two school teachers, was raised in Quebec City, Canada. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau offered his condolences, calling him a comedic genius and a great Canadian. He was a stand-up comic and briefly a writer for the sitcom Roseanne when he was picked up to join the cast of Saturday Night Live in 1993. He became known for his eccentric impressions, including Burt Reynolds, who gave Will Ferrell's Alex Trebek character grief on Celebrity Jeopardy. He also impersonated Bob Dole, Larry King, and David Letterman. His deadpan style and skills as a writer made him the choice to host Weekend Update. Simpson was a favorite target. MacDonald opened the fake newscast the week of the former football star's acquittal on murder charges by saying, "Well, it's finally official. Murder is legal in the state of California." MacDonald was fired in the middle of the season in 1998 by NBC Entertainment executive Don Olmeyer, a friend of Simpson's who reportedly didn't appreciate the SNL star, making Simpson the near-constant butt of jokes. "I was never bitter," MacDonald said in the oral history Live from New York, released in 2002. "I always understood that Olmeyer could fire me because he was the guy who owned the cameras, so that didn't bother me. I was always happy that SNL gave me a chance." He said in the same book that I just like doing jokes I like, and if the audience doesn't like them, they're wrong, not me. Olmeyer said that was his problem. "When Saturday Night Live is really good, they do care what the audience thinks," he said. "And when Saturday Night Live is not really good, they're kind of doing it for themselves and their pals." MacDonald went on to Letterman's show to announce that he was fired. During a commercial break, Letterman asked him, "This is like some Andy Kaufman thing with fake wrestling, right?" MacDonald recalled, "But it wasn't." Letterman was a fan who made MacDonald one of the guests in the CBS Late Show host's final run of shows. In 2016, Letterman told the Washington Post that the show would have had MacDonald on every week if he could. "He is funny in a way that some people inhale and exhale," Letterman told the Post. "With others, you can tell the comedy, the humor is considered. With Norm, he exudes it. There may be people as funny as Norm, but I don't know anybody who is funnier." The Post story was headlined, "Will somebody please give Norman MacDonald another show?" As if to answer, Netflix 2 years later aired 10 episodes of an interview series, Norm MacDonald Has a Show. Guests included Letterman, Lorne Michaels, Jane Fonda, and Judge Judy Sheedlin. He had limited success in other TV ventures. He created and starred in the ABC sitcom The Norm Show, later shortened to Norm, playing a former NHL player kicked out of the league for gambling and tax evasion and forced into community service as a social worker. A Comedy Central show, Sports Show with Norm MacDonald, lasted only a handful of episodes, but he kept busy in comedy clubs. "In my mind, I'm just a stand-up," he told the New York Times in 2018, "but other people don't think that. They think, oh, this guy from SNL is doing stand-up now." In a 2011 comedy special, MacDonald said it was wrong to say when you lost your battle with cancer when you died. "I'm not a doctor, but I'm pretty sure that if you die, the cancer also dies at exactly the same time," he said. "That, to me, is not a loss. That's a draw." Jim Carrey tweeted that MacDonald was an honest and courageous comedy genius. Seth Rogen said he essentially ripped off his delivery when he started acting. "No one could make you break like Norm MacDonald," Jon Stewart said on Twitter. "Hilarious and unique." For sports. Heartland Splits Out of State Triangular, by Austin Heinen. And there is a photo of looks like a girls volleyball team And the caption is, Heartland Christian coach Heather Heffernan speaks with her team before the start of the second set on September 24th, 2019. And it looks like they're putting their arms in a circle for a cheer. The Heartland Christian volleyball team went 1-1 in Monday's triangular tournament at Boys Town in Nebraska. The Eagles lost to Heartland Christian in three sets, 25-13, 23-25, 25-17, but bounced back to defeat Boys Town, 12-25, 25-21, 25-19. Both teams are in our conference, so it was good to be able to play those teams, Heartland Christian coach Heather Heffernan said. We usually have a hard time in that gym and coping with the environment, but the girls did really well to stay focused and play strong in this tournament. The Eagles lost a tough battle in their first contest of the day to College View, 2-1 in a best of three matches. The Eagles lost the first set, but bounced back in set two, before falling 25-17 in set three. Grace Heffernan led the Eagles with 12 kills and 6 aces. Maddie Junt notably had 7 kills. We struggled a bit with our serve receives here, Heffernan said. It's just some fundamental stuff, and perhaps a few nerves were involved as well. We came into this game missing some girls, so there were some adjustments based on that. College View is a good team. We struggled with a few adjustments there. Heartland then played its second game of the day against the tournament host Boys Town when the Eagles overcame a rough first set to win the match in three sets. The Eagles found themselves trailing 12-0 in set one of this match, but from that point onward, Heffernan was pleased with how her girls responded to the adversity. It was a good game for us, Heffernan said. My girl had a really hard time adjusting to the environment at first. Boys Town had a big crowd there, and they were very loud. We were also missing some girls again this match, so we just had 6 players this game, but I was very proud of how they came together and found a way to rally back for the win after a tough start. It was very impressive. Junt led Heartland with 9 kills in this match and had 6 digs. Casey Brennan contributed another 4 kills for the Eagles and had 9 assists and 2 aces. Heartland Christian's Tuesday game against Omaha Christian Academy was canceled. Therefore, the Eagles' next scheduled game is slated on Thursday against Whiting at 6 p.m. in the Iowa West Fieldhouse. Weekend visit Seals Deal for Dicks by Peter Huginen. The number one basketball recruit in Iowa, according to 24/7 Sports, Abraham Lincoln senior Josh Dix wasn't quite sure where he wanted to go to college before last weekend's visit to Iowa City. Dix announced his top 5 schools on August 24th. Drake, Wisconsin, Utah, Wake Forest, and Iowa. The 3-star recruit visited Iowa on September 3rd. His experience there sealed the deal for his commitment. It feels great, getting a lot of stress off my shoulders, Dix said. It feels great when I'm glad with where I ended up, too. Dix had been talking to colleges for a while, but it wasn't until the AAU season in April that colleges offered scholarships. They hadn't been really able to see me play, and then in AAU they just started watching me this summer, Dix said. It's definitely always been a goal to have that high level. I didn't know if I'd ever make it there, so to get there is super relieving. AL head coach Jason Isaacson said he was proud to see his player accomplish such a goal. It's really exciting. Just set out big goals, he said. You try and develop a plan and kids have to decide if they want to put in the time to reach a big goal like that. That kid has worked his tail off on his game, just on his body. He's really just went all in on it. It's nice to see him get that offer and be able to play at a power school. I'm really excited and proud of him. The kid really did his work, really did work his butt off for it. Through 3 seasons at AL, Dix currently has 1,033 points and 137 made threes. His performance as a Lynx and during AAU caught the eye of the Hawkeye coaches. I took an official visit to there last weekend, Dix said. It was just a great environment. The guys were super cool off the court. I watched a couple practices and really loved the way they play. Just unselfish and fast tempo. After taking some time to talk with his family, Dix was ready to make the choice official. Me and my parents had been talking about it last week through the week, he said. I just made it official last Thursday. Dix's journey started long before his high school days. He was first introduced to basketball when he was 3 years old. I had a little hoop, so ever since I was 3, I just kind of fell in love with the game, he said. Just the hard work and seeing that I could make a living off this. I just want to keep doing this. I have a really fun time doing it. Dix said he is unsure of what he is going to major in, but is looking into the business school right now. After his time at Iowa, he hopes to be involved in basketball as a player or a coach. And there's a couple pictures of him. One is him in a black jersey being guarded by someone from Ames, and it says Abraham Lincoln's Josh Dix shoots against Ames in the Class 4A state tournament quarterfinals Wednesday at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. Ames won 54-37. There's another one of Josh taking a free throw during the fourth quarter against Southeast Polk in the sub-state final on March 2nd. And there's a large student section, it looks like, behind him. And finally, there's a final picture of him in a white uniform shooting over Southeast Polk's Chase Bartlett during the third quarter on Tuesday, March 2nd. AL headed to Heartland Hoops Classic by Peter Huginen. Abraham Lincoln's basketball drastically improved its strength of schedule on Tuesday when the Heartland Hoops Classic bracket was announced. The Lynx will play the number 5 ranked team in the country, according to ESPN, Sunrise Christian Academy from Bel Air, Kansas, at 5:30 p.m. on February 12th at the Heartland Events Center in Grand Island, Nebraska. AL senior and recent Hawkeye commit Josh Dix is the number 1 rated prospect in the state of Iowa, according to the 247 Sports, and will be the highest rated prospect in almost every game the Lynx play. This will not be the case against Sunrise Christian, who raised 5 seniors ranked in the top 208 players in the country, including Mark Mitchell, who is the number 11 ranked player in the class of 2022, according to 247 Sports. "It's an opportunity," Abraham Lincoln head coach Jason Isaacson said. "Obviously, they're going to be pretty stacked and loaded, obviously, with Division I guys at every position and basically their whole bench. It's just a chance for us to play and see where we're at. Some of our guys get to see where they're at and compete against that level of team. We're looking forward to it. We know it's going to be a tough one, but we're excited." Mitchell is uncommitted, but is down to his final 4 schools: Duke, UCLA, Kansas, and Missouri. Also on Sunrise Christian's roster is the number 30 ranked prospect in Kansas commit Gradley Dick, number 85 prospect in Florida State commit Cameron Cohen, number 138 and Baylor commit Dylan Hunter, and unranked 3-star prospect with offers from Alabama, Marquette, and Oregon, Willie Lightfoot. They also have the number 58 prospect in the class of 2023, Layden Blocker. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, September 15th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Again, I'm Teresa from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.